So with that, I just want to welcome you all to Holiday Magic and Medicine Making. We're going to cover a lot of ground today, starting in a place of lore, just sort of talking about philosophy and stories around the holidays, and then moving into different plants and herbs and really how to be working with them for medicine, for gifts, and just for overall holiday cheer. So I always love to start with a meditation, so we're going to do that today to just really bring ourselves into presence here. I know a lot of us, maybe we're rushing to get here. So wherever you're at, just find a comfortable seat, comfortable place to be. So whenever you're ready, you can just let your eyes gently close. I invite you to begin by just taking a deep breath in and sighing it out. Another deep breath and maybe an even deeper sigh, really giving yourself permission to let go of any tension or anxiety here. And as you breathe, I'd like for you to imagine that there are small twinkle lights right inside of you. And with each breath in, each small light is coming alive. Feel that oxygen invigorate every cell in your body, feeling it bring light to your being, perhaps feeling even more expansive in this moment. And now just using your breath really as a vehicle to tap into this inner space, this space where you are expanding and inviting in this light, the space where you can really be at communion with a deeper stream of magic. And I'd like for you to imagine in your mind's eye that you're walking through a beautiful snowy wood. And the sun is down and the stars are out. And the sky is so bright that you can navigate by these small, small lights in the sky and the path of the moon. And just imagine yourself following a path that you know well, deeper and deeper into this forest wood. And as you go, you can begin to shed any of the worries or anxieties that have been heaped upon you in these past few weeks, anything that doesn't serve you and your ability to bring yourself in lightness to this place, you can just let it go. Let it fall like flurries into the snow. And just continue walking until you enter into what feels like a sacred grove. A sacred clearing in the middle of these woods. And right at the heart of this grove is an evergreen. And as soon as you see this tree, your heart leaps out in recognition. And you walk in a reverential way up to this beautiful evergreen. And in this moment, you know you're here to honor and love and decorate this tree, to show your reverence, your gratitude just to be here at this time on this earth. And so looking down at your feet, you might find decorations here to give to this being, maybe strings of popcorn, small garlands of apples, maybe even moving into the fantastical. Little spinning tops or different colored lights that you place like precious candles onto the branches of this tree. And in this moment, I just want you to create a connection with this living being of the world, imagining your love pouring deep down to the roots and all the way up through the tippy top of the crown of this beautiful tree. And as you wrap this tree in your love, I invite you to make a wish for this holiday time. Perhaps a wish for yourself or a wish for the world. But let this wish flow out of you. And let it become another decoration upon this beautiful tree. And whenever you're ready, just stand next to this tree and just feel the sensation of being so connected, so loved, so light, and through this communion, so very free. Taking a deep breath in and out. Really feel yourself planted here, rooting down in this wonderland, igniting an even brighter flame of hope at the center of your being. Whenever you're ready, you can let your eyes gently open, returning back to this room and this time, turning back to our serenade here. I think there's this. Okay. So, part of why I wanted to offer that meditation is because this is truly the season of lights. And as we went around and some of us were sharing what we loved about this season, I heard light come up a lot. And there's a reason for that. So we are literally in the Celtic calendar, what you would call the darkest depths right now. This is the darkest time of the year. And we kind of forget that because winter sort of stretches on past solstice, right? But really, this right now is the darkest it's going to be. And I don't know about you, but for me, my experience in our wider culture right now has felt very much so like the darkest depths. So traditionally, this was a time to remember the light. This was a time to, even in the darkest place where night fell so quickly and perhaps you were, you know, really starting to move into your stores of food, right? Your stores of sustenance where, you know, you had some ways to go yet. This was a time to really like reignite the candles and say, even in the darkest place, there is light. And it's kind of like this remembrance that, you know, we can't see the light until we're in the darkness, right? So even lighting a candle, right? When we light a candle in a dark place, think about how much more potent and powerful that candle is, how much more it like affects us, you know, affects our nervous system, affects our mood to light a candle in a dark room versus lighting a candle in a room that's already pretty lit, right? So I just want to share this right now because I know that moving into the holiday season, especially this time of the year, it can feel a little bit like there's so much going on in the world. Like, is it even like appropriate for me to like, you know, bake and listen to Charlie Brown and like wrap my presents? But really, truly, this is you lighting a candle in a dark place. And this is what we all need right now. We need for all of us to be like lighting our candles. And to really be bringing our light here. So for me, this feels like the perfect time, really, to be dropping into celebration and cheer, to be lighting the candles that are our hearts, to be coming back into this world with hope. So one of the things that I find most powerful about this time of the year is that it is the only time of the year in which it is like collectively condoned in our culture to believe in magic. Right? So there's like no other time throughout the calendar year, especially like in American culture, where it's like cool to believe in magic. So I remember, for example, growing up, I was really into Santa Claus, like super into Santa Claus. So much so that I believed in Santa Claus like way past when most people believed in Santa Claus and it was like considered appropriate. And I still believe in Santa Claus to this day, so I'm just putting that out there too. But really, for me, what I see now about this like really strong, like loving relationship with Santa Claus was that I loved believing in magic. to me, I didn't want to give that up. Like, that was such a part of, like, my heart, and it was the only time of the year where it was okay. And I grew up in a real, like, northeastern kind of, like, you know, intellectual culture, and so it was really just, like, uncool most of the time to believe in magic. So to just remember that and remember how potent that is, because I really feel like doing this kind of work with plants, with herbs, in so many ways is magic. It's bringing magic back into this world, and we need this magic. We need it now more than ever. So just remembering, like, how potent this actually can be. This is a time in which, in our culture, it's totally possible, right? Like, anything is possible. We believe in miracles at this time. And that's really potent, because when we can bring our consciousness in alignment with the reality that magic is real and start to believe in miracles, they can truly happen. So all of this said, what we celebrate now as the holidays is really like a conglomeration of a lot of different traditions, and I just kind of want to, like, give voice to some of that. First and foremost, this is a class that is going to be largely about plants and herbs. And why this is important is because what we consider to be most especially the conglomeration of Christmas time is really sort of a beautiful quilt of different, mostly pagan traditions. And where do these pagan traditions come from? Why? Celebrating the natural world, celebrating the plants. So when we talk about holiday magic and we talk about infusing herbs into the holidays, we're really talking about, like, going back to the roots of what was truly celebrated and recognized during this time. So as most of you in this room would know, these holidays, really, the reason why they're happening right now is because of the solstice, is because of the winter solstice, which is really, solstice means sun stands still, because if you look actually at the horizon, the sun would sort of be lingering at the same point on the horizon for a few mornings in a row before it started to move again. So this is indicative of it being the longest night of the year. And again, here then we have the days grow longer after our solstice, which is normally around the 21st of December. So really, this was a celebration of light in the darkest time. And you can see this celebration throughout many different, what you would consider pagan or earth-based religions in the Northern Hemisphere. So a lot of our traditions can even go as far back as the Romans. So for the Romans, this time period was Saturnalia. This was the festival to celebrate the god Saturn. So has anyone ever heard the term Saturn return? Okay, so Saturn return is basically describes about every 28 years, Saturn returns to the same point in the sky that it was when you were born in your birth chart. So this is astrology. Now, if anyone's ever heard this term Saturn returns, you know that, like, when Saturn returns, like, shit gets crazy. Like, Saturn returns and it's like there's, like, melancholy and depression and dissolution and things falling apart. So this is like the realm of Saturn. So for the Romans, like, Saturn was the god that really ruled over, like, the depths, the deep, dark places, this idea of, like, things dissolving and coming apart. And so during this time when they were celebrating Saturn, it was like a crazy bacchanal. I mean, like, drinks and parties and vomitoriums and, like, the whole nine yards, right? So really, part of where the bacchanal aspect of celebrating Christmas time comes from can go all the way back to this idea of Saturnalia. And this is also, we can trace back the theme of bringing evergreens into the home all the way back to the Romans and even farther back to the Egyptians. So why bring evergreens into the home? We're going to talk about evergreens as a medicine in a little bit, but really, it's very intuitive, right? Evergreens are the only plants in many parts of the world that are still green at this time. So you would bring this plant in, you would bring this tree in total reverence for the life that is still giving and maintaining. So in some traditions, the Yule log, have people heard of the Yule log? Was literally like you'd cut down a whole tree and you'd bring it into the house and you'd, like, stick the end of the tree in the hearth and you'd slowly burn it. That sounds like a crazy fire hazard to me. But that definitely happened. You can see some old illustrations of just like a tree sitting inside someone's home. So again, we look at these ideas that a lot of these celebrations were tied into reverence for the natural world. And so if we look specifically at Yule, if anyone's ever heard that term Yule, sort of coming out of the Germanic pagan tradition, Yule literally means wheel. And that was a common word for the sun being a wheel, and just really recognizing the way in which time moves in these cycles. And so this is a time to really sit back in reverence of that cycle. So this whole sort of referencing to the lore of the holidays would not be complete without talking about Santa Claus. So some people think that Santa Claus was an invention by the Coca-Cola company, but it's actually not true. Santa Claus, a lot of the aspects, most of the aspects that we think of as in line with Santa Claus actually come from the Dutch Sinterklaas, who had like the red fur-lined jacket, like would leave gifts for children. And instead of a like sleeping cap, he had like a, you know, like a Dutchman's cap. So that changed. But, you know, a lot of times when we think about Santa Claus, we tend to think about America, and there's a reason for that, because the sort of what we think of as contemporary Santa Claus was really developed in America, and that was through this Dutch influence that we had so strongly here in the Americas of the Sinterklaas. There's also some elements in there of Father Christmas that really became popular in England around the time of the Reformation. And then, you know, we also have little tidbits here of Odin, the Norse god, especially when we talk about leaving out treats for the reindeers, for example. That was really tied into Odin. So I would also like to say, and this is not something that's been like necessarily proved in any way, shape, or form, but I think it's a really cool connection, that there is this sort of connection between the idea of Santa Claus and the shaman. So shaman is actually a Tungustic word from Siberian, far Siberian indigenous peoples. And a shaman was one who saw in the dark. And so really what that means is a shaman was someone who moved between the realms, interacted with the unseen realms to bring back healing. Just coming back to this idea that what we see as physical reality surrounding us is just one layer of reality. There's actually many different layers of reality beneath that, what you would call different layers of consciousness and being. And so a shaman would travel between these layers. Well, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this sort of floating around on Facebook, but I think it's a cool connection. I talk about the idea that some of these influences for Santa Claus might actually be coming from these shamans from the far north, in that they would oftentimes eat Amanita mushrooms, and they would see reindeer flying. It's very typical when you talk about shamans working and going into the unseen realm that they would fly. This is consciousness leaving the body and going on these journeys. So these are just some of the sort of associations you want to pull in here, and I think it's really powerful to think about this idea of the fact that we sort of celebrate Santa the shaman every December time. And you kind of would have to be a shaman, right, to like visit every child in the world throughout one night. Shamans bend space and time, right? They move outside of the normal linear reality of time. And so really, in so many ways, Santa Claus is our collective cultural shaman. So, you know, I share all of this again because I think that because of the commercialization of the holidays in our culture, we kind of had the reaction to like shut our hearts often to this time and be like, all right, I'm not going to celebrate the holidays because I think that, you know, all this like buying and craziness and people getting run over at the mall is like just total BS. And it is, right? That part, people getting run over, not good. But if we can get back to the roots, right, we can really see that this is like such a profoundly magical time. So I want to say one more thing just about specifically these mountains that we live in, that the idea of the 12 days of Christmas actually is really tied into this area and was first developed in this area. So before we got onto the Gregorian calendar, Christmas was celebrated on January 6th. And then when we made the shift to the Gregorian calendar, Christmas got moved to the 25th, but people were like not into that. And especially here in these mountains, actually, it was only like maybe 100 years ago, less than 100 years ago, that people started shifting that from the 6th to the 25th. People were pretty isolated out here. And so they were like, no way, we're going to keep this old calendar. But so one of the things that happened was this tradition then that has roots here of celebrating the 12 days of Christmas. So starting on the 25th and having that be like sort of a bacchanal, like party time. And then slowly moving to the sixth, and by the time you get to the sixth, having it be more about, you know, family and prayer and quietude. So if you listen to some really old Christmas carols, you're going to hear that they actually talk about Christmas being on the sixth. So it's just an interesting little tidbit here. All of this said, I feel like plants are such an incredible gateway to really connecting into the profundity of this time. And there are certain plants that I love to work with in particular for really opening the gateways of experiencing magic, both for ourselves and with our families. So let's go into talking about some of those herbs now. So the first plant I want to talk about is pine. So did everyone get their white pine tea? Awesome. I'm also going to pass around a little sampler here of some white pine honey. So who here is familiar with pine? Yay! So here's the really cool thing about pine is that pines are distributed across the world. So you're going to find pines pretty much in every niche and nook of our United States here. So this is a medicine that is quite prolific in the world at large. So you can really go to most different ecospheres, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, and find pine. Here in these woods, our common pine is white pine, Pinus strobus. So you can easily identify pine from other evergreens because they have rounded needles, and they generally have 1 to 5 needles per fascicle or bundle. So if I pass around this little sample of pine, you're going to see that if you take one little bundle, you should be able to count 5 needles in that bundle. And that's how you know that it's white pine. So white pine has 5 needles per bundle. So I'm going to pass this around if you just want to take a look at that. Now, a lot of what I share about pine is actually really applicable to other evergreens. So it's completely applicable to fir, to spruce. The one evergreen that you want to be extremely careful not to harvest would be yew, right? Yew is toxic. So that said, if you are going out into the woods and you are harvesting an evergreen, especially around these climes, you're pretty much mostly going to find white pine or at higher elevations, spruce and fir. So white pine, I wanted to start with because it is an evergreen. And, you know, we kind of lose sight of how profound evergreens are in our culture at this time because we have houseplants, we have greenhouses, we have indoor gardens. Well, can you imagine what it was like when the entire world died around you and basically it was just the evergreens that were still here and were still alive, right? Profound, really profound. So evergreens were traditionally a part of celebrating this time because they reminded people that even in death, life survives. And so this is like one of the most profound sort of lessons of the holiday time is, again, even in the darkest depth, light survives. Even when everything else seems like it's dying, life continues on. It really is. Moving into winter is like crossing over this threshold and like moving beyond death in a way. So evergreen medicine, just like as an energetic medicine, is something I really feel like we need in this country at this time, especially if you feel like just looking at current events, like something like you're like, whoa, okay, things are dying. Good things are dying. Hopefully not so good things are dying too. And just to remember that, like, there is a way beyond death, and that's what we're finding right now as a culture. We're finding that way beyond death. And evergreens can really help us to do that. So pine has a really long history of use as a medicine. Pine is really high in vitamin C. So in order to get its vitamin C content, you want to use pine fresh. So you can use fresh needles in a tea, like I made for you all today. You can also infuse it into a honey or just chew on it. And so this was something that native people showed European settlers when they came, to actually chew on pine and make pine tea as well as spruce and fir in order to keep scurvy at bay. So there's a tale that Captain Cook and his crew never got scurvy because they brewed all their beer with spruce. Now, I don't really know if vitamin C can actually survive the fermentation process, but I think that that's a really interesting story. So this was super important, right, throughout the winter months, because now we can just go to the supermarket and get, like, oranges galore. But back in the day, that was not the case. And that was, like, one of the major deficiencies that we would have during the winter season, which would be a vitamin C deficiency. So you can tell if anyone, if those needles are going around and anyone wants to try nibbling on some, you can tell it has that really citrusy, orangey taste to it. So you can really taste that vitamin C there. So pine is also really highly antiseptic and antimicrobial. So antiseptic, it was actually used externally and internally. So antiseptic means externally, antimicrobial. Antimicrobial means internally. So you would use it for coughs, colds, flus. We would be using both the twigs, the needles, and the bark. At this point in time, I mostly recommend just using twigs, small branches, or needles, because there's really no reason to, like, strip bark from a whole tree, because that will kill a tree if you take, you know, a whole bunch of bark from the heart of a tree. But you would take these twigs, these branches, these needles, and you would make either an infusion or a decoction. So because we're talking about medicine making here, I just want to go over the difference between an infusion and decoction. Infusion means you boil water, and then you pour that boiled water over your herb, you put a lid on it to keep all those aromatic oils in, and then you just let it sit. So if you've ever made a tea bag, then you've made an infusion. I would say the only major difference would be most people, when they've learned how to make tea bags, aren't necessarily told to put a lid on it. But really, putting a lid on it will keep all those delicious volatile oils in there and just make the medicine that much stronger. So in contrast, when you make a decoction, you're going to do decoctions with harder, woodier materials, so things like roots, bark, branches, some berries. To do that, you're going to put your material, so say you have white pine, little small twigs or inner bark, you're going to put it in your pot with the water. You're going to bring both the herb and the water to a boil. Once it hits boil, turn it down to a simmer and put the lid on it, just like you would make with white rice, for example. Does that seem clear to everybody? Difference between infusion and decoction? Okay. So we make an infusion for lightweight materials like needles, decoctions for heavier things like bark. So if you were to treat yourself, for example, for a cold, you would either make an infusion from the needles or a decoction from the bark of white pine. So white pine has a particular affinity for our lungs, which I don't know if you've noticed in the wintertime, it seems like you get lung grunge, right? It just really starts to settle in our lungs. So thinking about things like bronchitis, for example, this is a great medicine for that. Pine is also somewhat aromatic and stimulating. Can you guys like feel that, especially when you smell the essential oils, right? So it has this ability to actually like get our blood moving and flowing, and we're going to see this actually as a theme throughout some of the other herbs that we're going to talk about today. Another thing I want to say about pine in particular is this idea of the wounds being the place where the healing happens. So when we're using pine externally in a salve or literally just right on a wound, Native people would use it as a sticky bandage over wounds. To keep them from getting infected. Where that's coming from is actually coming from the sap or the resin from the pine tree. And that happens when the tree is wounded. And the reason why it's so antimicrobial is because this is how the tree is healing itself, right? A tree gets cut or gets damaged, maybe by an insect, and it starts to excrete this resin to help itself heal. So for me, this feels like a really profound connection, right? It's just remembering that the wounds are really where our deepest healing come in. So as we go into wintertime, I know for a lot of people, wintertime can be kind of like a deep, dark time. And the holidays can sometimes be a dark time, especially for people who've lost family members or in a difficult place. And so just to remember that, you know, these wounds are places that, like as Rumi says, the wound is the place where the light enters you. And so I think it's really profound to think about working with resins in that way. And you can find pine resins at, you know, different herb shops or online, for example, with Mountain Rose Herbs. One way to work with them is to actually let them sort of simmer on your wood stove to like fill your house with like yummy antimicrobial aromatic oils, or even just melt it and include it into an oil that you might rub directly on your skin. So pine, lastly, I do want to say it is a slight bit of an anodyne, which basically means pain reliever. Now, it's not like a super strong pain reliever. Like if I, you know, like had my foot cut off and someone was like, morphine or pine? I would definitely go for morphine. But it has this like slight anodyne properties. Say if you're thinking about something like a headache, for example, you might notice that it can really help. And I think part of that is its stimulating nature, that it actually helps like stimulate and move blood flow, like, you know, our circulation. So questions about pine or any stories or comments people want to share?
You mentioned buying resin.
But
what is it? Do you ever harvest it, and if so, how?
Yeah. So the way I like to harvest resin is actually to just look around the base of a tree for resin droplets that have fallen. If I'm collecting it from the bark of a tree, I like to either collect it once it's dripped down from the center wound, or once like it's completely hardened. If you're collecting like resin that's fresh from the wound of a tree, you're basically taking away that tree's Band-Aid, so I would not do that. But you can look at where, you know, old trees have been wounded, old wounds, you'll see like a drip, and you can sort of just like collect that drip. And especially, it's not as prolific out here. You can find some prolific resin out here, but if you go out west, like there's like, you will find like huge resin chunks just hanging around. But thank you for that. Thank you for that question. Yeah. I just want to share one more story about like evergreens being this gateway to like the way beyond death. There was a species of pine called the longleaf pine that used to dominate the Southeast. So from Virginia, basically all the way down to towards Texas, was this vast forest of longleaf pine. And if you see a lot of traditional basket weaving with pine, here's an example. This was made with the longleaf pine, mostly. So what happened when European settlers came here is they basically decimated this forest of longleaf pine, mostly to use the pine as masts for ships. So they cut down these pines to use for masts for these ships that basically fueled like this whole southeastern part of the United States, like really like drove the whole like boat building business for like several hundred of years. And so now there's only actually like a few spaces of longleaf pine forests left in our country, like specifically if you're going down towards Florida. But there's a really great initiative, the Longleaf Pine Alliance, that's actually replanting longleaf pine forests here. And it's a sad story, but it's also like a beautiful story to just think about this idea that even in sort of like the ways in which we've misused the environment and have increased, you know, decimation in some ways, like we're still finding ways beyond it. These forests are still regenerating themselves. And that this pine, it's amazing to think that like this pine was like from this part of the world, like literally went all over the world in these masses, these ships. So anyways, just to say that there is always a way beyond death, and we're finding that right now. Last thing I want to say about pine, just because it's cool, for all of you guys who have wood stoves, you probably already know this, that pine burns really fast and really quick and really bright, right? So this is like great fire starter, and you can think about this as, you know, just medicine for yourself, that you're taking pine medicine in a lot of ways is like fast and quick and bright, and it really increases that like inner hearth inside of you. Has anyone ever smelled the essential oil too, or just gone for like a walk in the woods and like literally feel your mind brighten and clear? Yeah, that's definitely like part of pine's medicine. It's this brightening and this clearing. Yeah, actually on that note, I did want to share, I meant to share about it as a flower essence, because I think this can also help us tap into the medicine. In Bach's Flower Essence Compendium, so flower essences are what you would consider like energetic medicine or vibrational medicine. How you make flower essences is you just float the bloom in water, and then you take that water in basically a homeopathic dosage. White pine, or pine in general, let me pour this. Pine in general as a flower essence is all about guilt. So if you feel a lot of guilt in your life, pine is a good remedy for you. And definitely the holidays can be like rife with guilt. I don't know if anyone has families that like, you know, will guilt trip you for whatever it is, you know, like not being home for long enough. You know, not spending enough time with the family, all those things. Or if you just tend to heap guilt on yourself, like I'm not doing enough, I'm not making it special enough, et cetera, et cetera, then pine might be a really good remedy for you during the holidays. Okay, so I'm going to pass around our next tea here. And this is spicebush tea. I'm also going to pass around some of the twigs of spicebush. And if anybody wants to, maybe I'll pass this around too. This is a whole little branch so you can see what it looks like in the wintertime. But if anybody wants to, so there's twigs and there's a couple, there should be a couple berries. Where are those berries? Oh, here are the berries. So the berries are red, but they've turned black within a day. I picked them yesterday. The berries have high oil content, so they tend to go pretty quick. So you don't dry them when you use them. I'll talk about this in a moment. But just know that normally the berries are red, but pass that around if you want to see. And if anybody wants to take a little bit of the twigs and chew on it or take one home to chew on it, you're welcome to. So let's pass that around this. All right. So let's talk about spicebush because this is a medicine that is not talked about that much. But it's one of my favorites. So spicebush, you have all seen it before, even if you don't know that you've seen it. Spicebush actually has a wide distribution down the whole eastern part of the United States, pretty much from Maine all the way down to Florida. Spicebush is called Lindera benzoin. That's its scientific name. And you've probably recognized it in the early spring. So if you've gone out walking in the woods in the early spring and you've seen an understory small tree or shrub that has like this wand of beautiful little yellow flowers just growing right along the axis of the branch, then that's spicebush. So spicebush gets its flowers before its leaves come out in the spring, and it likes to grow in like moist sort of woodland places. The settlers who came into this country would oftentimes look for spicebush to basically as an indicator of soil fertility. So you will often find that spicebush grows near a lot of old home sites. So if you go, you know, wandering in the woods and you know there's an old home site somewhere, look around to see if there's spicebush, or vice versa. Look around to see if you can find spicebush, and I guarantee you that there was an old home site not that far away. So spicebush is called the allspice of the Americas. It's because of the way in which its berries in particular, but also its leaves and its twigs can be used similarly to allspice. So can anyone taste that in the tea? It really has its, even though it's called the allspice of the Americas, it really has like a medicine all its own though. It has this like really yummy lemony taste to it. Can you taste that? Isn't that so good? This was actually one of the first edible medicinals I ever learned about, like back when I was a teenager. I had Steve Brill's book, if anyone knows Steve Brill, Wild Man of New York. He has a great book about wild edibles, and I like found out about spicebush, and I was like, oh my gosh, I know where one is. And I would like just go and eat the berries, even though it's like so pungent and intense. But I just was so excited that I knew about something that I could eat. So spicebush is another medicine that was actually a really big and traditional part of Native medicine here. So it was a big part of traditional Cherokee medicine, and it was used very specifically for wintertime colds, flus, and coughs. So what I would say about spicebush is that it's a good remedy when you feel like something is coming on, when you get that like rot-row, like you wake up and you're like, oh man, something's happening. Oh no. Like this is a good time to start taking some spicebush. It was also traditionally used for rheumatism, so for wintertime aches and pains. And part of the way in which it's helpful with that is it's very aromatic and stimulating. So a lot of times when we take herbs that are, you have that aromaticness to them, most often those herbs are therefore going to be very stimulating for circulation and therefore really helpful in things like rheumatic aches and pains. So it's a cool thing to remember. This was also what you would consider an expectorant. We can say the same thing for white pine. An expectorant actually helps us expel out of our lungs. So in wintertime in particular, we tend to get these really boggy lung conditions, right? So this is another herb that you would use to actually help like expel the bogginess from one's lungs. One of the reasons why I really wanted to talk about this plant is because we tend to like have this reliance upon or super excitement about like foreign spices, right? And they're like super exotic and fun, like star anise and cinnamon. But it's really cool to also find out that we have our own, you know, versions of these like spicy aromatic herbs right here in our hills, growing right here. So if you haven't ID'd spice bush in the springtime where it has those like beautiful small yellow flowers, then you could really challenge yourself to go and try to find it now. So here's what I did. I just moved to a place this fall after the leaves were all down, and I was like, I know I want to harvest spice bush for this class. I wonder if there's any spice bush here. And I'm like walking up the path, and I'm like, okay, so spice bush normally stays around like 5 foot tall. Sometimes it can get a little bigger in ideal conditions, but mostly it's this understory plant. So it stays around my size. It has smooth bark with lenticels on it. So if you see that branch being passed around, lenticels are these little white sort of sketch marks or dots on there. And this is where air exchange and gas exchange happens on the plant. So you can see the little lenticels on there. It has a smooth bark, and it tends to be like, you know, sort of very like elegant and light plant, like sort of long tapering branches, right? So I'm thinking all of this to myself, and I'm walking along, and I'm like, yeah, like that. It looks just like that. And I like walk over and I break off a branch. I'm like, oh, that is it. This is all spice bush. So spice bush grows clonally most often. So you're going to find it like in these patches all together. And you will know it's spice bush because you will break the twig and you'll smell it. So, you know, give this a try. Like, don't go out and, like, decimate every shrub in your woods. But, you know, just keep those ID points in mind and go, huh, okay, this has smooth grayish bark. I see those little white dots, those lenticels on there. It's an understory tree. I see a bunch that kind of look like it right around here. Let me just break a twig and smell it. And you will immediately be able to smell whether or not it's spice bush. So my favorite way to work with spice bush is as a tea, and this you would make as a decoction. So anyone want to give me a refresher of what a decoction is again?
It's when you cook the water down. So you do that with bark usually, or berries, and you basically put the plant and the water in, and then you cook it down to a certain level.
Yeah, so basically you're bringing it to a boil with the water, simmering it, and putting the lid on it. The lid is really important. Most aromatics, actually, people recommend making an infusion with them just because the aromatics are so volatile. This is how we make essential oils, right? Those aromatic compounds are so volatile that as soon as they heat up, they're like, boom, I'm out of here. They rise up and out with the steam. That's how we make these like steam distillations of aromatic oils. So when you're making, say, a decoction with something like spice bush, I like to keep the lid on it the whole time because then that really keeps all those aromatic oils in there. So just to also throw this in there with spice bush, it's a really great remedy for like nausea and indigestion, which tends to happen around the holiday times, like overeating, binge eating cookie dough, etc. And you can use that as a steam for your sinuses to like, so you could make that decoction and then tent your head over the decoction with a towel and really breathe it into your sinuses if you're having some sinus congestion. Okay, so the berries obviously come out in the fall, and you might see those berries being passed around right now. The berries have a high fat content, so they tend to go rancid if you would just try to dry them. So I recommend either freezing them, or you could actually just try to like actually put them in a dehydrator and do it quickly. So those are two ways to go about it, and you can keep the seed in or remove the seed. It's up to you. Okay, questions about spice bush?
Maybe that type of flavor.
It has more like lemony to it, I think. It's a little less sort of like cinnamon spice and a little more like mellow lemony spice. That's how I sort of think of it. But it would be really cool to try to make like an allspice deodorant from it. I don't know how you would do it. I think you could because isn't there a man's deodorant that's like really popular that's like basically allspice smell? What do they call it? Old Spice?
Old Spice.
Okay. How I would do that is I would take the bark or the small twigs and I would, or the berries, and I would like put it in a double boiler in the oil and we're going to talk about double boilers in a minute, so if you don't know how to do that, I'll talk to you about that. And I would infuse it into the oil, and then I would try to make a deodorant out of that. Just, that's a side thought. That's a way, way side thought right now, but I thought it was a cool idea. Okay, other questions about Spice Bush? So just in terms of harvesting bark and twigs, I just want to say, most of the time if you have a small twig, you know, like smaller than your pinky, you can just chop that up into pieces and put it right into your decoction. But if you have a bigger branch, you're going to want to strip the bark. So the best way to do that is just to get a sharp knife. And always stripping away from you, right? And make sure no one's in front of you. But just holding the branch, it's just, you're basically going to strip out the outer bark and the inner bark down to the where it's woody, which is basically if you just do one strip, like you would sort of peel an apple, then you'll get that strip off. Okay. So we're going to keep on steaming here, and we're going to talk about sassafras. So, spice bush and white pine that I passed around so far don't really have contraindications, but sassafras does, and we're going to go into that. But really the one that I just want to say right at the get-go is contraindicated for pregnancy. So if you're pregnant, don't take sassafras right now. But for everyone else, if you want to try this, this is a sassafras syrup. So this is a recipe that I have in your handout, and this does not have alcohol in it. So if you're... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you are avoiding alcohol, this should be fine. It's just honey and sassafras decoction. So you could take anywhere from a drop to a whole squirtful in your mouth, whatever pleases you. Let's start around this way. So first, let's talk about sassafras in general. I love sassafras. It is one of my favorite herbs, so I'm really excited to talk to you about it today. Sassafras has a super long history of use here in this country. It was a really important part of Native American medicine traditions here. And sassafras has similar to spice bush, like that distribution. You can really see that with sassafras too, like far north and then all the way down into Florida. And so sassafras actually was one of the first major U.S. exports. So before tobacco was like a big thing, sassafras was all the rage in Europe, partially because they thought it could actually like cure syphilis, which is not necessarily true, but it got to be really popular because of that. It was like a popular tea thing to have. And they were exporting it in mass, really, out of this country. So that was like one of our first major exports, actually before, you know, the United States was the United States. So sassafras, most people know, as was mentioned here, that it was a traditional ingredient in root beer. So when you taste it, you might be like, that tastes just like root beer. And that's because the sassafras was used in that. Now, what we use medicinally with sassafras is what you consider the root bark. So just like we strip the bark from a tree and use that bark to make medicine, we're stripping the bark from the root with sassafras. So you would dig up the root, and you would take a knife and you would strip basically that first layer of the root, and that's what you're using. Sassafras is an herb of commerce. Unlike pine or spice bush, you can find sassafras like in most, you know, herb catalogs. So if you're not into digging your own, like, it's definitely something you can get and experiment with. That said, sassafras, you can really use all parts of the plant. So in particular, the leaves are also a medicine, and they're a slightly different medicine. So just to talk about that first, the leaves are very mucilaginous. So if you don't know what that term mucilaginous means, just say it really slow to yourself. Mucilaginous. And then you'll know. So mucilaginous is like, it's moisture producing. It creates basically like mucousy, this is going to sound gross, but it's really great, sort of like mucousy, slimy conditions. It's really hydrating for our mucosa. It's hydrating for our skin cells. So if you eat something mucilaginous, like okra, for example, you know that like slime in your mouth? That's mucilage. So mucilage is really healing for our skin tissue because it sort of makes this like hydrating bandage pretty much over our skin tissue. So when we drink something that's high in mucilage, we're really helping to like heal the tissue in our gut. So we use sassafras leaves in that way to help heal the tissue in our gut. And it was traditionally used to thicken soups. So anyone know filet? So sassafras leaves are filet. So that's what filet is made from most of the time, is that's actually powdered sassafras leaves. And that came originally from the Choctaw people. Then the Cajuns sort of took that on, and now it's known as a part of Cajun cuisine, and specifically in combination with gumbo. So sassafras is really easy to ID in the warm months because of its three leaf shapes. It has the simple leaf shape, the mitten, and the three prong. So if those three leaf shapes are on the plant, it's most likely sassafras. The only thing it can really be confused with is mulberry. But really, that is not really that big of an issue around here. But so if you find those three leaf shapes, you've most likely got sassafras in your hand. Sort of, you can take the leaf and sort of grind it up in your hands and sniff it, and it should have that spicy sassafras smell to it. So let's talk a little bit about sassafras medicine, because it's pretty cool and inspiring. So when I passed that around, did anyone taste how, like, sort of like spicy and bitter it was? The bitterness maybe might have been a little denatured by all the honey in there. Okay, so sassafras is a great example of what we'd call an aromatic bitter. So I'm bringing sassafras in part to this discussion for the holidays, because the holidays are like the time in which we need bitters. So bitters actually kickstart our digestion. So traditionally, when we eat something that's bitter, a lot of times we're maybe not supposed to be eating that thing, right? So if something's bitter, what it tells our digestion is like, hey, you want to secrete a lot of bile, a lot of enzymes to really make sure that whatever you're eating can be digested, because a lot of things that are difficult to digest tend to be bitter, right? So that's the plant's way of saying, don't eat me. Well, really, that said, there's a lot of foods that are bitter that we've, you know, evolved eating. We've really cut bitters out of our diet in a really big way as a contemporary culture. But actually, these bitters are important to really stoke these digestive fires. So an aromatic bitter is really important because it's actually warming while it's stimulating this digestive component. So if you tend to run cold, so you get cold hands and feet a lot, for example, your digestion tends to be sort of sluggish, boggy, a lot of bloating, you're probably running cold and you need a warming bitter. A lot of times people read about bitters and they're like, okay, bitters are for digestion. My digestion sucks. I always feel super heavy after I eat big meals. I think bitters would really help me. And then they get a bitter like dandelion and they're like, oh gosh, this isn't helping. And in fact, it's kind of making things worse. And it might be because they already run very cold and dandelion is just too cooling for them. So if you run cold, you're going to really want a warming bitter. So how we use bitters is you take them in drop dosages about 20 minutes to half an hour before your meal. So say if you had that syrup right there, you could just take like, you know, 15 drops of that. And as long as you're tasting the bitter on your tongue, it's going to be basically sending the message to your liver and gallbladder to produce more bile and therefore have easier digestion when you eat your meal. Now, there is a reason why we have our pre-dinner cocktails, right? So this is to get our bitters going. And so this syrup that I'm passing around right now is a really great one to make and have on hand when you're making your sort of digestive cordials for yourself. All of this said, bitters work best before a meal, but you can take them after. So if you, you know, go to the holidays and you have a huge meal and you're like, ah, I forgot my bitters, just take them as soon as you remember, and it always helps. So just going deeper into the medicine of sassafras, sassafras is another one that is indicated for like wintertime colds, coughs, and flus because it's highly antimicrobial. It's also highly moving and stimulating. And different herbalists have different things to say about this kind of quality. So some herbalists will say it's very moving, it's stimulating, it's warming. And some herbalists, like Matthew Wood, would say it's so moving and it thins our blood so much that it actually can cool you down. So all of our bodies are different, and I think you're just going to feel how it feels in your body. I tend to run really cold, and I haven't noticed that it cools me down, but I do notice that I can take it in the summertime, and I don't get overheated. But that said, this is one of my favorite antimicrobial herbs to take when I do feel a cold or flu coming on. And in particular, I've had really good success with sassafras and food poisoning. So if I feel like I actually have a stomach bug, like what's happening is in my stomach, to get some sassafras right there in my stomach, it's really effective at actually like killing whatever bacteria is. Bad bacteria is breeding right there, because we want to keep the good bacteria, right? Sassafras is another one that was used for rheumatism, wintertime aches, and it was super traditional in these hills as an alterative. Alterative means blood cleanser. So the way in which it was often used was it was dug up first thing in the spring, and it was boiled in a decoction and drank as a kind of spring cleansing. So alterative's or blood cleansers, they work in sort of what you might call mysterious ways, but basically they're aiding our detoxification process. So when you talk about cleansing the blood, we're talking about helping basically our body move and dispose of the wastes that are, you know, normally moved and disposed of through our blood. So this was another reason why I wanted to introduce sassafras during this class, because the holidays tend to be a party season. So if you like come out on the other side and you've had like one too many hot toddies and you're like, all right, I'm ready to do a cleanse. I love just drinking sassafras tea like somewhere around the new year to just like really sort of invite in this new era and beginning with a bodily cleanse. So one of the things I want to make sure I talk about with sassafras is its sort of like major like flashing in the contemporary world contraindication. And that would be, dun dun dun, safrol. Who's heard of safrol before? Okay. So basically, if you look at a lot of commercial sassafras, you're going to see safrol-free sassafras. So here's why. Basically, what they did is they isolated the compound safrol out of its matrix in sassafras, and they gave it in extremely high doses to rats. And they found at extremely high doses, this isolated compound out of sassafras can have mutagenic effects inside of these rats. And so from there, basically, like, this, like, whole, like, just intense cascade of fear came about of, like, don't use sassafras, don't use sassafras, it causes cancer. What's funny is that sassafras has actually been used for thousands of years in part to prevent cancer, and they've actually found with studies that sassafras can lower people's risk of getting cancer. So what is all this hubbub about safrol? Well, so what I would say about this is it's basically similar to what we do with pharmaceuticals, in that we isolate a compound out of a plant, we give that compound out of its matrix to someone in much higher dosages than they would be getting normally inside of a plant, and whoops, things go wrong. So really, to me, I feel like sassafras is a safe plant. What I don't feel like is safe is isolating constituents out of their natural matrix. It's kind of like how I liken it is like taking someone out of a super functioning community. Like if you look back at traditional societies, right, everyone had their role, their place. Well, if you took that one person out of their community and you sort of just like threw them out on their own, they might do some crazy stuff, right? They might do some like just crazy stuff to like get by or survive or whatever. This is kind of what happens with plant constituents when we take them out of their matrix. This is why herbalism is about whole plants. And this is why when we're talking about herbal medicine, we're talking about really using these whole plants and recognizing that there's a synergy that happens with their constituents that's incredibly important. And we can't just isolate one single constituent out of that and expect it to act in the same kind of way. So I wanted to say that about safrol because it is something that people comes up for people and worries people. So as with everything, I would say, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Do your own research. Find out what feels right to you. And as for myself, I always look to traditional usage. You know, if a plant has been used for thousands of years as medicine, I tend to go with tradition over contemporary lab test results because I think one just speaks louder than the other. So that's my truth. So with that said, I want to talk about how I make this sassafras syrup. And so this syrup recipe you can use to make any kind of syrup, including, and this is so good, white pine syrup. So, so delicious. I also saw when I was doing some research before this class, I saw a post about making spice bush syrup ice cream, which sounds so good. So you could look that up, Spice Bush ice cream. But so here, this is a really basic syrup recipe that you could use for anything. For this, I have it with sassafras, but the basic components of a syrup are two things, and then an optional third thing. So the two things you need are some sort of water infusion or decoction, and some sort of sweetener. So that's salt, that's honey, that's agave, you can use maple syrup. So traditionally, syrups were made to preserve a medicine. You know, back in the day, we didn't have refrigeration, and alcohol, at least in some places in the world, was hard to come by. So you would make a syrup with a sweetener to actually preserve that medicine longer. Now, that said, now we love syrups because, you know, kids tend to be willing to take them, and they taste really good on top of pancakes or in drinks. And so you can choose to make this syrup with just your sweetener and your infusion or decoction, or you can preserve it with alcohol. But the basic, most basic recipe is literally to just make a very strong tea, either through an infusion or a decoction. So make that very strong, and then do one part tea to one part sweetener. That's it. That's the most basic syrup recipe you can do. If you're using something like sugar that's not already liquid, you would dissolve it into the tea, and you can actually keep boiling off the water to condense it down to be the kind of consistency you want. You can have it be more watery or more thick and syrup-like. Now, if you're working with something like honey, for example, you can do an additional bit of magic, which is to infuse the honey. So the way that I'm going to talk about infusing honey right now is the way that I made that white pine honey that went around. So you guys can really tap into this idea of starting to make some infused honeys for the holiday season. So the fastest way to make an infused honey, and at this point the way you would go about it if you wanted to make it as a gift, is to do the stovetop method. So if you have a double boiler, you would use a double boiler. If you don't have a double boiler, you can make a double boiler. So the way that you make a double boiler is just that you have a big pot, and you put water in that big pot, and then you're going to take a mason jar lid or a couple mason jar lids, and you're going to sit those lids in that bigger pot, and then you're going to take a smaller pot and sit them on top of those lids so it's not touching the bottom of the pot, it's not going to get too hot, but it's submerged in that water, and then inside this smaller pot is where you're going to put your honey and your herb. So really, if you don't have a double boiler, like I said, you can make one with just two pots, a bigger one, a smaller one, some water in that bigger pot with a couple mason jar lids to keep that smaller pot off the bottom of the pot. And then you're going to keep that basically on low to medium, depending on how your stove is, for anywhere from 1 to 6 to 10 hours. The longer you do it, the better and the more yummy and the more flavorful the honey is going to be. One thing to keep in mind if you're not using a double boiler, if you're kind of like creating one, like I just mentioned, is that water is going to evaporate off. So you got to make sure you keep adding water to it, because if the water evaporates off totally, not only can you sort of ruin your pot, because then you're just going to be heating up metal on metal on metal, but the honey will get too hot. Ideally, you want to keep the honey warm, but not so warm that it doesn't feel comfortable on your skin. That's like the good ratio. It's, you know, basically if you put it on your skin, it should feel like, oh, that's warm, but not like, oh, that's hot, that's burning me. Because honey has all these great properties as a raw medicine, right? So we want to try to keep it in that raw range as much as possible. But really, this is the fastest way to do it. You just put your herb right in there with that honey. You infuse it on the stovetop. And then when you're done, you just pour that honey out through some sort of strainer or maybe even some cheesecloth to get all the bits and pieces out. And voila, you have your honey done. So that's what I did with this sassafras. I did it on the stove for about 2 hours in the honey. In general, if I want to make sure I have a strong honey, I basically just put all my herb in the pot and I just cover my herb with honey. So no need to bother too much with measurements when you're making honey. You just cover your herb with honey. And sort of the more honey comes up, the less strong it will be. Does that make sense? So it's like if I have my herb and then I have like 3 inches of honey over the herb, that'll be less strong than if I just have one extra inch of honey to cover that herb. So that is the fast method. That's the stovetop method. And I really encourage you to try this with pine, for example, because it makes such a good holiday gift. People love it. And it's so, so, so tasty. It's actually, you can preserve vitamin C that way as well. Not as much as you would with a tea, but it's part of its medicine. You can also do this with a variety of different dry herbs. So The sassafras that I pass around, that syrup was made with dried sassafras. I also want to pass around this honey. So if anyone still has your utensils, you can try some of this honey. This is a honey that I make every winter called Warm Hearth Honey. So this says star anise, vanilla, wild orange peel, clove, and cinnamon. And so this was, again, made with this stovetop method. So I'll pass some of that around if you want to try. And the last thing I forgot to pass around but do want to send round now is this is what the root bark looks like when it's stripped, sassafras. This was probably stripped like 3 years ago, so it's starting to lose its smell and its potency, but it's amazing that you can still smell it. So when you find sassafras and you strip the root, most often it's going to be red. So there'll be just a little bit of red root bark when you strip it. Sometimes, though, you're going to dig sassafras and it'll be yellow. Now, technically, they're the same. It's the same thing. It's one species, Sassafras albidum. But in these hills, old-timers here talk about red sassafras and yellow sassafras as different things. So if you find sassafras and you dig the root and it's not red and it's yellow, just know you still have sassafras. And it's good to go. Yeah, that was just air dried. Yep. So just one extra step I wanted to talk about with the syrup. If you want to preserve a syrup long term, you can add alcohol to your syrup. So if you don't add alcohol to your syrup, I would say a syrup with about the half-half ratio that I have in that sassafras syrup of honey and water would last maybe about 2 weeks in the fridge. If you want to add alcohol, it could last forever. So if you want to just make a syrup and have it last forever, say maybe you want to make a cough and cold syrup with the herbs we talked about so far, right? We have white pine, we have spice bush, and we have sassafras. If you wanted to make that so you just had it on hand for any time in the future, you just want to add about 20% alcohol by volume. So the easiest way to think about this is if you're working with brandy, which is 40% alcohol by volume, you would basically want to make sure that half of your bottle was that brandy, because then you'd have 20% as in total in that whole bottle. Does that make sense to people? So you want to look at the percentage of alcohol that you're using and just know that for something to be preserved long term, it needs 20% alcohol by volume. And so you just do that math to figure that out. A really sort of easy base method for this is to just do one part each. So one part infusion to one part honey or sweetener to one part alcohol. That's a really easy way to do it. You just keep it in the fridge, especially if you have a higher grade. That's more for a higher grade alcohol like vodka, and it should last you forever. And you can go that extra step with that alcohol and infuse the alcohol too to make a tincture. We're going to talk about cordials next, but basically making an infused alcohol is a way of really preserving your medicine super long term, and it's incredibly easy to do. Basically, you just get herbs, you pour alcohol over it, you cover it, and that's it. So you can actually make a sassafras syrup with sassafras tincture, sassafras honey, and sassafras tea.
So here's a question. The sassafras saplings that I have near my house are small, and they're also growing on pretty steep slopes, so I haven't ventured into harvesting them. When you harvest the root of a sassafras tree, what is the best way to do it that might preserve the tree and is the least violent?
That's great. That's such a good question. What is the least violent way to harvest the roots? Sassafras also likes to grow clonally. Mm-hmm. So the best way to do it is, so find a patch where they're growing, sort of follow the root down, and then you can actually harvest the rootlet that connects the two trees. So you actually don't have to kill a tree in order to harvest the root. So find one root, one tree, follow its root down, and then sort of follow it underneath the ground. It normally won't grow too far down beneath the soil, so you can really follow it with your hands till you find that rootlet that's going in between two trees, and then you can snip that stretch of rootlet, and yes, you disconnect those two trees, which is very sad. But ultimately, you're really keeping those two trees alive while you're harvesting that side root. So that's what I would say. And actually, I find it way easier to harvest them on slopes when they're on slopes, the roots tend to be sort of higher towards the surface and less likely to be like super overgrown into stones. So because they can be, like all roots, can be hard to dig. And it's important if you're doing the one where you're, that technique where you're finding the rootlet, the side root to make sure you connect that into a sassafras. Don't just dig in between two sassafrases and hope to find the root, because there's a lot of roots in the woods, and you might think that it's sassafras, and it could not be. So just, you know, make sure you connect that back.
And then do you harvest something, like for personal use, how much do you harvest?
Depends on how much you use it. So I tend to work with sassafras mostly as a tincture. It's sort of like one of my go-to tinctures when I'm having like upset stomach or feel cold coming on. And so, you know, I would say, you know, doing that technique, you know, if I do that maybe like 5 or 6 times, like that's probably enough tincture for me for a year. You know, that might make like, you know, 4, 6, 8 ounces depending on how big that was. Yeah. Okay. Other sassafras questions? Okay. And if anyone's like, this is so much information, don't worry about it. Like, all these ways of making the different medicines are all in your handout, so you can go back to it at any time. So we're going to get more boozy in this moment. So if anyone's down to get more boozy, this is your time. And we're going to talk about hawthorn. So this is a hawthorn brandy, a hawthorn cordial that I made with, we're combining everything we've learned so far. So it's brandy infused with hawthorn berries, with honey infused with hawthorn berries. And actually, I don't think I put tea in here. So this is just brandy and honey. Both have been infused with the hawthorn berries. It's quite delicious. So I'll pass that around. I'll keep it with its lid in case you want to shake it back up again, because some of the sediment will come out. This is such a good cordial to make for the holiday season, and here's why. So hawthorn is a gatekeeper of the heart. In Western medicine, in European medicine, hawthorn is considered to be a cardiotonic. So on a physical level, hawthorns actually help our hearts to be better pumps. They help our arteries be more elastic. So this is actually one that you would take, you would give to someone who, you know, has heart disease, or even as a prophylactic before you even get to that point. But why it's so good for the heart holiday season is on several levels. One, hawthorn in European lore was considered to be the gatekeeper for magic. So hawthorn trees were often like these gatekeepers to the fairy realm. So you want to be careful if you step under a hawthorn tree, or if you fall asleep under a hawthorn tree, because you might just wake up in the fairy realm. And then you'll dance all night, and then you'll come home, and it'll be 100 years later. Bummer. So why hawthorn trees in part were considered to be these gatekeepers of the heart is its action on the heart, is this idea that our hearts are the portals through which we perceive magic. And sometimes when we're not seeing magic, it's because we're trying to see it through our brain. And that's not where we perceive magic. We see magic through our heart, through the consciousness that is our heart. Now, in a lot of traditions, you're going to see that the heart is actually considered to be, like in Chinese medicine, the emperor of the whole body. The heart is the seat of our consciousness. And we see this in a lot of traditional cultures, that the heart, you feel with your heart, right? You see with your heart. And now we actually see that there is more like sensory neurons in our heart than we ever thought. Actually, 60% of our heart is made up of sensory neurons, sensing the world around us, and that there's actually more information that our heart sends to our brain than our brain sends to our heart. So our heart is telling our brain what's up, and then our brain's like, okay, based on this information from my heart, I will make these decisions. So really, our hearts are these like gatekeepers to perceive magic. And so when we can open our hearts, we can just see and experience more and more and more of these subtle realms. We literally open our consciousness when we open our heart. So like literally, when you think about the Grinch and like his heart like growing all these different sizes, it's like, think about how much more magic he's experiencing, right? He's expanding his consciousness, and he's able to actually feel and experience things he didn't feel before. So hawthorn helps us to open our hearts to these innate magics. Hawthorn actually also, on an energetic level, has this aspect of both togetherness and protection. So if you've ever seen a hawthorn tree, hawthorns like to grow sort of in hedgerows and at the edges of fields, and they're most easily identifiable by their thorns. They have these very straight thorns. Hawthorns also bloom around Beltane and fruit around Samhain, which were two Celtic holidays that were acknowledged as times of the year in which the veil between the worlds are thinnest. So there's that association as well. And that's another way to identify hawthorns. But really, hawthorns are most easily identifiable by their thorns. And so in herbal medicine, this is what you'd call a doctrine of signatures, something that tells us about its medicine. Like you can just look at a plant, and by looking at a plant, understand what its medicine is or what kind of healing it holds. Well, these thorns are a doctrine of signatures for our hearts. And it tells us that healthy hearts have good boundaries. So this feels really important going into the holiday time, right? That loving and having an open heart isn't about being open to absolutely everything and everyone, you know? It's about being open and also having these boundaries of what needs to come in and what is better on the outside, what can stay there, you know? Maybe you get like your Uncle Lou gives you like an underhanded comment and you're like, all right, Uncle Lou, like I'm gonna hawthorn you right now. Like you're gonna stay here with that comment. And I'm gonna stay here and it's good. So boundaries are important. Boundaries are really important, and hawthorn on an energetic level can really help us to do this. So again, when we're thinking about this idea of magic, it's like, how can we tune into the incredible magic that's surrounding us all the time if the gates are completely open to absolutely everything, you know? If we're, like, ingesting, like, every hurt, every pain, every side comment, it's like we're sort of taken out of this flow of, like, really being able to connect into what's most vital and most important. So hawthorn helps us to do that. And, you know, I also want to say that hawthorn and just heart remedies in general are really important during the holidays as we gather with our families, as these healings happen, as we reestablish connections with those that are important to us, you know, whether that's blood family or chosen family. And, you know, they've actually found that one of the leading factors in heart attacks is loneliness. That literally loneliness is a factor in the amount of heart disease that we have in our culture, loneliness and isolation. And I think that this is important, especially as, you know, we sort of have this illusion of interconnection a lot with our phones. Like, it's really easy. I'm, like, in bed. I'm like, oh, look at all my friends, you know. But then I'm like, oh, I actually feel lonely right now. So the holidays are a really important time to really, like, reconnect with those that are meaningful to you. And recognize that, like, by nurturing, like, your energetic heart, you actually nurture and protect your physical heart as well, which is so important. So hawthorn was used as emotionally as a remedy for grief and heartache. Both the berries and the flowers were used in this way. I like to use both in formula. A lot of herbalists will talk about using the flowers more for acute grief, and the berries more for sort of like ongoing sadness or grief. But I like to put both in my grief formulas. It's kind of like moving through an experience to see that there's still fruits on the other side. You know, no matter how painful a loss has been, there is still fruit that's waiting for you in your life. So I like to use both when I'm working with a formula. I will say, though, that the berries are high in vitamin C. They are actually very nutritious. They're considered to be a food medicine, so they're safe for all people to take. And the berries are more highly of a nervine than the flowers. So nervine means it's actually relaxing your nervous system. So sometimes I'll put the berries into formulas just for plain relaxation. So I think about it sort of like one of the indications that makes sense for me is someone who has like a lot of like sort of like tightness and hardness around their heart, and it's sort of like they have like muscle cell tightness and they're like really sort of like tight and hard in the world, and they have really trouble relaxing at the end of the day. You might want to put some hawthorn in there because it's kind of like starting from the heart on out. It just, you can kind of like let it go a little bit, right? Because a lot of times this heart tightness, like the people who you're like, oh my gosh, like, for example, you know, whatever, the Grinch or Scrooge, it's like the reason why they're so tight is because they're actually so sensitive. It's like they're so sensitive that they have to like put up these like really hard walls around their heart. And so hawthorn helps people who are really sensitive in that way to like feel like there's this protection, there's this energetic protection, so they don't have to have the walls be so hard or so thick. So if you think about Scrooge, for example, if anyone knows the Christmas story, right? Like he goes through this whole transformation at the end. He's like the most biggest hearted person, right? He's like taking care of Tiny Tim and feeding the poor and all of those things. And, you know, that was inside of him all along, right? That he didn't like, it's not like he changed who he was. That was inside of him all along. But, you know, this is what can sometimes happen to people who are really sensitive in a really hard world is we put the hardness right here around our heart. So Hawthorne can really just help to soften that up and create this flow of connection. So if what I'm describing reminds you of anybody in your family, make some Hawthorne cordial and just give it to them. Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, that, yeah, you're going to get drunk and then you're going to be so open. And so, no, but yeah, I mean, you know, even just like making a cordial and having like a small sip at the end of the day, you know, or just having the berries on hand and making some tea, you know, just like having that medicine be a part of your ritual. Yeah. So I have directions here of how to make the Hawthorne cordial in your handout, but it's super easy. And if you're interested in making it, you could literally get some berries today or in the next few days, and you could have this made by, you know, Christmas time if you celebrate Christmas. So basically, you just put the berries in with brandy, you let it sit, you know, the longer it sits, the more flavorful it will be. Generally, the time frame is about a week to 6 weeks. And then you just siphon that brandy off, you pour it off the berries, and then you combine it with honey. So you can just do plain honey, or you can make an infused honey like we talked about earlier. And if you want the cordial to be less alcoholic, you could also make a tea. So we could do sort of like a syrup with you do the three parts, right? With you do the tea, the honey, and the alcohol. Except if we're making a cordial, we'd sort of up the alcohol and the tea amount and lower the honey, right? So you can see syrup, like a syrup and a cordial are very closely related. It's just about proportions. With a cordial, it's more looking for something more drinkable. With a syrup, we're looking for something more concentrated that you take in smaller dosages and tends to be more viscous. Okay. So let's talk about chaga. So this is chaga. This, like, very woody, hard, warty looking thing. I'm going to pass this around. I also have for you all a chaga chai or chaga hot cocoa. So this is a maple, chaga maple hot cocoa. It is sweet. It is chocolatey. It has coconut milk in it. Delicious, basically. So let's talk a little bit about chaga. And then there'll be cookies. So this is good. This is how we're going to end. Chaga is called a medicinal mushroom, but that's actually kind of a misnomer. It's not a mushroom. Chaga is the mycelium. So the chaga is the fungus itself. So mushrooms are the fruiting body of the mycelium. So, you know, when you see a typical mushroom in the woods, what we're looking at is kind of the flower or the fruit, you would say, of this whole network of fungus called the mycelium. And this mycelium underlays our entire world. And what we found actually with a lot of contemporary research is that this mycelium is a vastly important part of the way in which our forests operate. That through this network of fungus, trees are actually sending information to one another. They're sending nutrients. So trees are letting another tree know, like, hey, there's this dude here chopping down trees. Or they're letting them know, hey, this insect is coming. You might want to up certain constituents. And they even actually help sister trees, brother trees, who are not in a good place, giving them, sending them nutrients. So actually, mycelium is like this, like, amazing, it's sort of like the internet of the forest, where all this information and sustenance is being sent along to one another. So chaga is literally an outgrowth of this mycelium network, which is really special. We don't really find this anywhere else. So chaga, it grows on birch trees. And here in this climate, we're going to find it on yellow birches mostly, but chaga up north, you can find it on white birches or gray birches. And so chaga, when it grows out of the tree, it sort of looks like this, like, gnarled, dark, woody wart, which makes it not sound good, but it's really good. And so you actually kind of have to saw it off of the tree in order to get it, and it's really prolific in far northern climes. So a lot of sort of the way in which we use chaga, it comes from Russia. And sort of one of its premier uses in Russia is as like an anti-mutagenic, as an anti-cancer herb. Chaga is also considered an adaptogen. So you guys are going to get to experience adaptogens a little bit more with some adaptogenic snickerdoodles. But adaptogens are basically herbs that help our bodies, hearts, and minds deal with stress. And oftentimes adaptogens are working within our endocrine, nervous, and immune systems to actually help us find homeostasis, help us re-find balance in these systems. So adaptogens can often help us when we feel depleted, fatigued, and just generally worn out, all of which tends to be the case by December 24th. So adaptogens can be really, really helpful to just keep our energy high during the season. The term adaptogen actually comes from the Soviets. They were trying to find herbs, work with herbs to actually give people who worked really long hours in factories, because work will set you free. Basically just to, you know, to help them work longer hours. So this said, you know, taking an adaptogen is not a substitute for rest when you're overworked. So please don't like be like the Soviets and just like dose yourself with adaptogens instead of resting. Like rest and be taking some adaptogens. So just help yourself stay strong during the season. So chaga is considered an adaptogen. And it's one of my favorite immune tonics, just keeping your immune system strong. It's what you would call an immunomodulator, which means that it actually helps our immune system find its balance point. This is particularly important in this time because we tend to be seeing more and more and more hyperactive immune conditions. So we tend to be seeing more and more allergies, autoimmune conditions. So actually what we need more so in our culture at this point is immunomodulators rather than an immune stimulant. So an immune stimulant would be something like echinacea or spilanthes, which is great if you feel a cold coming on, right? But if you need just general nourishment for your immune system, maybe you're someone who also experiences allergies, then something like an immunomodulator like chaga would actually be way better for you to be taking on a long-term scale. So this is something you take every day to increase your immunity. Chaga is also incredibly high in antioxidants, like one of the highest of any of the herbs, even though it's not technically an herb. We're just going to throw it in that category. So it's actually really beautiful paired with chocolate because then you get this amazing antioxidant combination. And chaga actually tastes like somewhat chocolatey. And how you tend to take chaga is you get, so if you find it, you find it in a big sort of brick, like I just passed around. But if you order it, you can order it as powder or ground up. And so you take it and you decoct it. And it's actually traditionally one that you would decoct for a long period of time. Oftentimes mushrooms, you want to decoct them for longer than you would something like a root. So I tend to try and leave my chaga on the stove for at least an hour. And if you have a wood stove, you can just put your chaga in with some spices, maybe some cinnamon and cardamom on top of your wood stove and just sort of let it sort of simmer away all day long and just keep taking cupfuls of it. And if you have a chunk of chaga, like a cupful or like a handful of chaga, a lot of people will actually use that same chunk over and over and over again until the water begins to get pale. So you want the water to be like looking like dark chocolate, or it, you know, it'll get lighter and lighter. This is me wishing I knew more different wood types. Anyways, so basically, so you want dark, like the different dark colored woods, and then if it gets lighter and lighter, say it's like a beech wood, I think that's light wood, get rid of the chaga at that point. But basically, you want the water to have color. But you can keep that chaga on the stove and just be simmering it, really, for days. All that said, my absolute favorite way to eat chocolate, Freudian slip, to eat chaga is with chocolate. So good. Can you guys all taste that in the hot cocoa? Yay! So just keeping on this topic, let me take one more step back. I want to come back really quick to talking about the idea of mycelium and the mysticism of this time, because in my mind, there's something really magic that happens when we're working with mushrooms, we're working with fungus and mycelium. There is something about the way in which they connect us into this collective unconscious, in which they connect us into this unseen network that underlies our earth. And this is part of the magic of wintertime, right? It's sort of all the hubbub is stripped away. I mean, we're still in the hubbub time now, but moving into January, it's like all these outer doings fall away, and we're invited to just go deep into the space of mysticism and consciousness. And there's something about mushrooms and chaga in particular that I find really helps me sort of like bring my consciousness into communion with the unseen world around me. It's kind of like continuing this flow of connection even when the life dies down. This mycelium is still underneath the ground and is still really transmitting all of this information. So I really think of most mushrooms actually as consciousness expanders. And so I use chaga similarly. I actually find that it helps me expand my consciousness and really helps me come into a state of like peace and communion before I sit down in something like prayer or meditation. So let's continue on with this theme of adaptogens for this last little bit of our class. And I'm going to pass around some cookies. So these are the adaptogenic snickerdoodles, which are in your handout. So these do have nuts in them. If anyone does not eat nuts, you'll see all the ingredients in there. These are gluten-free and I guess somewhat paleo, even though, you know, they have a lot of sweetener in there, etc. So I developed this recipe to be getting adaptogenic powders in my body and my diet during this time. And it's actually been pretty amazing to find like how much my family loves these snickerdoodles. Because you're gonna notice they're just a slight bit bitter. But like they have become such a hit, and I noticed that like when I'm eating them, my energy levels are just like so fantastic. I feel so zippy. I'm like, yeah, I can keep wrapping presents. Like, sure, I'll, like, you know, put the star on top of the tree. Like, whatever it is, I'll do it. And so I have three different adaptogenic powders in there. Ginseng, shatavari, and astragalus. So if you guys are interested in learning more about adaptogens and really going into the fine-tuned details between these different adaptogens, I really recommend David Winston's book, Adaptogens. So he does a really good job of talking about the history of adaptogens, some theories of the different ways in which different adaptogens work, and then he actually has profiles on the different herbs that we've isolated as adaptogens. But in general, adaptogens blend into different categories depending on where in the world you look. So like I said, adaptogen is a term from the Soviet Union. But you could also apply that term to tonics in a Chinese medicine viewpoint or rasayanic herbs in an Indian or Ayurvedic mode of medicine. So what all these sort of categories have in common are this idea of like generally nourishing the body, helping us find balance and homeostasis. Adaptogenic herbs tend to be safe to take in higher doses over longer periods of time. That said, each adaptogen has their own little, like, sort of specific fancy things that they do. So just to go over really briefly these three adaptogens in these snickerdoodles, ginseng, most people have heard of ginseng. It's, like, basically one of the most famous adaptogens at this point in time. There is Chinese ginseng and there's American ginseng. I recommend staying away from American ginseng because it has been so vastly over-harvested from our woods. It is like such a shame. So if you're going to use American ginseng, make sure it is ethically cultivated ginseng and not wildcrafted. But so ginseng in both Chinese traditions and Cherokee traditions, the name translates to man root. Because the root actually looks like a man when you dig it up. And in Cherokee tradition, it was said that ginseng was the grandfather of all of the healing herbs. And basically ginseng said when disease happened upon the earth, like when disease resulted, which resulted from an imbalance in our relationship to the natural world. This is part of the Cherokee story where disease comes from, taking more than we need to. Disease arising out of an improper relationship, that ginseng stepped up and was like, I will help you with everything. And so that's kind of like ginseng. Like if you think about it, be like, I will help you with everything. Ginseng is an immunomodulator. It's an immune tonic. I find it really particularly helpful with like burnout and fatigue, especially if you talk about like adrenal fatigue. Some signs of that are like dark circles under the eyes, like pale complexion, really trouble getting started in your day. Of all the adaptogens, ginseng is like one of the most like energizing, I would say. Like it really does like give you some good energy. If you tend to already be like super, super energetic, then ginseng might be a little too stimulating for you. But for most of us, it's actually just the right amount of stimulation. Shatavari comes from Indian Ayurvedic traditions, and the name translates as she who has hundreds of husbands. Ooh la la. So shatavari is known as an aphrodisiac, a fertility enhancer. But really the way that it's working in a lot of ways is that it's so nourishing. It's a medicinal asparagus, so it's so nourishing, it's so building, and it's really balancing for our hormonal landscape. So this is not just for female-bodied people. This is for male-bodied people as well. But so shatavari is just one of those that I actually use most often for like mood regulation, specifically mood regulation in conjunction with hormonal balance. That said, it is as well an immune tonic. And then lastly, we have our premier immune tonic, which is astragalus. So astragalus is sort of one of those adaptogens that's like, yeah, it's an adaptogen, but maybe not as much of an adaptogen as ginseng or shatavari would be. But where astragalus really shines is as an immune tonic. So tonic mean that you're taking it every day to actually like sort of keep that fire of your health like going and strong. So in some traditions, for example, because astragalus is from Chinese tradition, you don't take astragalus when you're already sick. Because astragalus is so feeding, in this way of thinking, you don't want to feed the sickness. It's something that you would take beforehand to really strengthen your immune system. And now is the time to do that. Because like definitely now is the time when we start to sort of run ourselves ragged. You know, we get a little worn down. So this is the time to really be building our immune system moving into the holiday time. What they say in Chinese medicine about astragalus is that it actually helps us have the protective energy in our Wei Qi. So there's three levels of being, energetic levels of formation in Chinese medicine. The deepest levels are Yuan level. This is like our soul level, like this essence of who you are. This middle levels are like Ying level. And then we have our outer level, the Wei. And this is where we're interacting with the outer world. So astragalus helps our Wei Qi, this space where we're interacting, to be really, really strong. So I sort of love that. You can kind of think about like astragalus giving you this like golden light that surrounds your body and helps this be like a safe space, an inner sanctum. So how do people like those snickerdoodles?
Good.
Pretty good, huh? So you can really make these with any powders that you want. You know, maybe you want maca in there instead, or you're working with cordyceps or whatever it is. If you have other adaptogenic powders, you can put them in there. But I promise you, just you know, taking those on a regular basis throughout the holidays is a really good way to soothe your sweet tooth and stay really energetic during this time. So any questions about adaptogens or anything that we've covered in this class? Yeah. Eleuthero is Siberian ginseng. Yeah. It's pretty different. I would say like Chinese ginseng and the American ginseng are pretty similar in their usages. I would say that Chinese ginseng is a little more stimulating than the American ginseng. And Eleuthero is just kind of its own thing.
You're recommending
the Chinese for the powder? I would. Chinese. Eleuthero also is really great. I would say Eleuthero is definitely not, it's not that stimulating, but it is really like building and nourishing for depleted energy.
Chaga grows in our woods rarely. Do you want to just make a note about ethical harvest and
sustainability? Yeah, so if you do find chaga in these woods, normally you're going to find it at higher elevations on yellow birches, like I said. And like Phil mentioned, it is sort of a rarity here. So, you know, most of the time when we're thinking about ethical wildcrafting, we want this 1-in-10 rule. So you want to only take 1/10 of anything that you see. And so for some plants, you would count 10 of them before you would ever take one. So in general, like 1/10 is a good harvesting rule to go by. All of that said, thank you all so much for being here, for like really rising up the cheer and bringing so much light to this space and this time. I really want to honor all of you and your magic and just really let you know how very much your magic and your light is needed at this time. So thank you all so much and have a beautiful holiday season.